Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
High gas prices. Some state leaders are asking, why are the biggest sport utility vehicles exempt from new fuel economy standards adopted only 2 months ago? And some states, the District of Columbia and New York City, are going further than that. Today, they're filing a lawsuit claiming that the new SUV mileage standards are not tough enough and hurt the environment. Joining us on the line from Washington is David Shepherdson. He writes for the Detroit News. And Dave, these states seem to be sending a message to the federal government that they're not willing to wait for tougher rules.
No, even though these new regulations have been in the works for several years, many environmental groups and others objected to the fact that when the government did the analysis to formulate the new fuel economy rules, they didn't treat gasoline with the correct price. I mean, currently we all know gasoline is about $3 a gallon, but when these rules were adopted, they estimated that gasoline was only about $2 a gallon. So they make the argument that under any sort of rigorous cost-benefit analysis, the automaker should be required to, you know, much more sharply increase fuel economy standards.
And, of course, the auto industry not happy about any increase in fuel efficiency standards because it means they have to rebuild their cars.
Not just that. I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars the big three have to spend, and what they don't like is, you know, building cars, smaller, lighter cars that they believe that consumers don't want. And they don't like being told what to do by the federal government about anything, quite frankly.
Well, while the states are suing the federal government over the CAFE standards, the so-called CAFE standards on SUVs and small trucks, you write that a Bush administration proposal to increase car fuel efficiency standards for the first time in two decades is on the fast track on Capitol Hill. This has to do with passenger cars. What's this proposal?
It's quite striking, actually. Just last week, President Bush proposed the new rule. The Transportation Secretary, Norman Mineta, sent a letter to Capitol Hill. There's a hearing set for Wednesday. They want to get the bill onto the House floor by next week. Basically, for two decades, there has been no increase in the 27.5 miles per gallon average for passenger cars, even though the automakers on their own have been able to hike it to 29 miles per gallon. The Bush administration and Congress want to show that they're doing something to address high oil prices, and one way is to show that they're telling the automakers, look, you've got to do better. We're not going to let the rules sit for 20 years.
And yet those cars won't be on the line for several years to come, right?
Well, that's the big thing. I mean, one, it's going to take a year to formulate a new rule. Then the public gets 6 months minimum to review that proposal, and then the automakers get another 18 months to build the more fuel-efficient cars. So this is by no means an immediate solution. We're talking about 3 years at least, potentially 4 years, well said and done, because the automakers, you know, could sue to block the new rules. So, I mean, this is something that might make people feel good in the short term, and in the long term, it certainly has the capability to save billions of gallons of gasoline, depending on how strict it is. But, you know, it's not going to drop the price of the pump this week or next week.
Well, and as we know, everyone in Congress is trying to do something, or at least show that they're doing something to bring down gas prices. But we read today that Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is now backing away from a proposed tax increase on oil companies. And the thinking was that this would help fund the $100 gas rebates that's been much discussed. But we also watched this morning, as you know, on the Today Show, as Katie Couric excoriated the senator with a list of criticisms of the $100 rebate. It seems as if that's pretty much dead.
Well, first of all, the gas rebate would apply to anyone, even if you didn't drive a car, you know, if you were a child. And there's no, and I think a lot of voters have seen it as a political stunt designed to make people feel temporarily better until, you know, until the election November. That's not even the strongest proposal. Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow has called for a $500 per person gasoline rebate. And, you know, I think a lot of voters see it as this is a temporary, you know, a temporary fix. You feel good. But if anything, it has the potential to increase the buying of gasoline. You got more money to buy more gasoline, potentially could raise prices. And then what happens next year, it's not a long-term solution by any means.
And if the money is given back to people to fill up their cars with gas, they are just turning around and giving that money back to the oil industry,
which is getting record profits.
David Shepherdson, Washington-based reporter for the Detroit News. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin.
Iraq's parliament speaker today called for an end to widespread bloodshed just as insurgents launched new attacks, killing at least 7 Iraqis and 1 U.S. soldier. The Sunni Arab speaker said the new government that's forming would bring an end to the now hourly murders, kidnappings, and roadside bombs. Well, U.S. military officials are also hoping that the new Iraqi government will stem the violence, but in the meantime, they're re-examining how to fight the war in Iraq by learning from, they say, mistakes made in the past, staging elaborate war games, and encouraging officers to question the way things are done. We wanted to find out more about the new training, much of which is happening at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas under the command of Lieutenant General David Petraeus, one of the U.S. Army's most experienced officers when it comes to Iraq. General Petraeus was the first commander of the Multinational Security Transition Command and was charged with training Iraqi soldiers, leading Newsweek to call him Iraq's repairman back in 2004. Well, General Petraeus now joins us in the studio. He's back stateside. And, General, we understand that, you know, part of this new thinking is, let's say, new software, enabling officers, for instance, to talk to each other and share information and even try to understand the tactics of an insurgent.
There's an enormous development in that entire area that takes the problem very holistically and tracks every step of the process of someone eventually planting an improvised explosive device and walks through that and figures out how to attack each step in that particular process.
Which is much needed. What about interacting with Iraqis? I'm just wondering if this is part of what these tactical teams are
doing. It's a huge part of it. We talk about the idea that knowledge of the cultural terrain is as important as knowledge of the military terrain. You know, we always used to be interested in where's the high ground? You know, will the bridge hold a tank? How dusty is the landing zone? Those kinds of issues were critically important to us. And those, as we were fighting to Baghdad with the 101st, that's what we focused on. Now, however, we're very much focused on who are the Iraqi leaders in this area. What sheikhs are represented? What tribes? What ethnic groups? Who are the religious leaders? How is the province police chief doing? Let's talk about the division commander and the brigade commanders of the Iraqi division in that area. What about language and culture training and appreciation of all that? So those are getting much, much more emphasis as our units prepare for Iraq. And by the way, we can even enable them now, in a sense, to virtually look over the shoulder of those units that are in Iraq through software, again, and a secure internet that the military has established, so that you can sit in an office at Fort Benning, Georgia, let's say, or Fort Lewis, Washington, and you can see the information display in the Tactical Operations Center of the unit that your particular unit might be replacing some months from now. So you can begin to immerse yourself in that situation well before your unit actually deploys.
You know, what do you say as I hear this? It seems to make complete sense. But I also can hear the voices on some right-wing radio that I've heard say this is not the job of the military to be a social worker or an occupier. I mean, are there people within the military also who are having a hard time adjusting to this kind of tactical work, you know, working with the people in that way?
Well, I think the military accepts the fact that it's needed that we do this. This is industrial strength reconstruction, if you will, industrial strength activity. We have civil affairs battalions, certainly, and we're, in fact, adding to the number of those over time. Certainly other members of the so-called interagency, if you will, and some members of the international community and international organizations are engaged in it. But at the end of the day, in a very difficult security environment, military units and leaders have to do a good bit of this. And that's why we talk about the need also to try to ensure that our leaders are flexible and adaptable. We talk about, in fact, the Army pentathlete leader. This is a leader who's not a one-trick pony, who can do lethal combat operations today and who tomorrow can do non-lethal activities in support of reconstruction and reestablishment of basic services. We used to say, in fact, that in the 101st, that our soldiers went out of their patrol base every day with a wrench in one hand and a rifle in the other. And they were prepared if someone had a hand grenade, but they were also prepared if someone extended a hand with a handshake. And if you see that handshake, you got to take it.
Right. That's asking a lot of people to make that switch.
It is, but American soldiers are up to that.
Well, you talk about these pentathlon leaders, I think you
pentathletes.
Call it? Pentathletes, right. But there also are apparently Jedi Knights. Can you tell us about these classes in the, I guess it's at the School of Advanced Military Studies.
It is. SAMS. That's the second year program at Fort Leavenworth for those, a very very select group, very competitive selection for those who attend the Command and General Staff College course the year prior. And they then become a real pool of very talented planners who go out to the various headquarters of our large units, divisions, corps, and echelons above that. And they are truly experts in the planning of all aspects of military operations, including logistics, intelligence, and the standard familiar operation.
What kind of exercises might they do at Fort Leavenworth before they go out?
Well, they'll do a combination of those that include very sophisticated simulations, which now, by the way, are extending beyond the old traditional combat lethal focused to now those that have injected into them a variety of activities that require non-lethal responses. So they must, in fact, interact with host nation civilians. They must interact with host nation security forces, Iraqi security forces, Iraqi provincial officials, if you will. And in fact, we gear the large exercises to actually help prepare units for the missions they'll perform in Iraq and even the locations in which they'll be located.
So some of them play the Iraqis?
They do not. No, no. We have role players that do that and a whole variety of people. And by the way, when we do the unit exercises out in the Mojave Desert, for example, at Fort Irwin, California, we actually do use Iraqis. There are about 300 Iraqi role players that supplement the 1,500 or so American soldiers who actually grow beards so that they can truly represent the terrorists of the world, and they'll strap on simulated explosives and so forth. And they use pyrotechnics and a lot of special effects. There are actually consultants from out in the Burbank and Hollywood area that help us do this because, in effect, our leaders out there are staging what is almost a little epic movie. This is sort of Ben-Hur out in the desert. In fact, if you woke up in the morning in this location and you were a little misoriented, you might actually think you're back in Anbar province. There are 9 or 12 villages, depending on where they draw the boundaries for that exercise. They have to interact with the locals in those villages. They have all the elements of Iraqi society there, the different ethnic groups, the different types of leaders that you'll encounter in a typical Iraqi community. And there are certainly insurgents and terrorists and extremists there as well.
We're speaking with Lieutenant General David Petraeus about how the Army is rethinking the way it's training officers and soldiers to go into Iraq. Well, just ahead, we'll continue with how the military is training officers to get out of their bubble, to question authority with something called designated skeptics. But we'll ask, how does that square with the recent backlash against criticism of Donald Rumsfeld? That's just ahead. Also, a reminder, later in the program, did you know that President Bush has never issued a veto in his entire presidency, the first president in modern history not to use the veto? Well, one reporter says he's doing something else, that he is end-running laws with something called signing statements. We'll find out more about that. That's coming up, much more coming up here and now. Stay with us. Commanding General of the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. And before the break, General, you were telling us about these war games in the California desert where actors playing Iraqis confront American soldiers. And the whole exercise gives the military a chance to rethink the way it's fighting the war in Iraq. Also at Fort Leavenworth, you are training officers to be designated skeptics. And this is part of something called Red Team University. Tell us how that works.
The Red Team University actually trains officers to be just what you said, professional skeptics. They're respectful critics, if you will, very well informed, well trained. They actually learn the techniques on how do you, in a sense, analyze plans, how do you analyze concepts and operations, and then how do you question those? How do you try to find where the weak points are? How do you probe at the logic? This has actually been used in Iraq. There have been elements brought together at various times by General Casey and by the ambassador in Iraq, and they've been very, very useful. And this is an effort to provide an institutional response that so that these individuals can be embedded at other levels below just those at the very top.
Well, and we understand it's overall to help avoid groupthink.
It is. Groupthink can really set in a situation. By the way, it can especially set in when you're very tired. And, of course, people work very long hours in a contingency like Iraq or Afghanistan. And so having someone sort of sitting who is disconnected or not completely bought into the program or part of the program can be very useful for leaders.
But that's not Americans' perception of the military. You know, the perception is that, you know, you join the military because you're going to walk in lockstep. And that's actually the only way, really, a military can succeed, you know. And that brings to mind, you know, the recent headlines, and you're well aware that recently several retired generals have called on Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to resign. And they were treated as pariahs. Was it because they said this outside of the military? Are you saying these skeptics are being encouraged within the military, but perhaps not outside?
Well, all I can talk about is, again, within the military, what we are certainly doing is trying, again, to produce flexible and adaptable leaders.
Is this a big shift? Is this a sound? Is sound well, as seismic as it feels?
There is a shift in the fact that our Army at the very highest levels, our Secretary and our Chief of Staff of the Army have embraced the idea, for example, of sending what will eventually be in a year or two some 300 captains to civilian graduate school. Frankly, people ask me on occasion, you know, what was it that helped you, that helped prepare you for all these unexpected endeavors that you had to get engaged in when you were the commander of the 101st in northern Iraq? And of all things, the number one preparation was my own experience in graduate school at Princeton University, where, again, I went from the Command and General Staff College to graduate school, and I found it was an enormous shift. You know, even in the Command and General Staff College, try as hard as we will to bring in provocative speakers, to bring in red teamers, to bring in anybody to challenge thinking, at the end of the day, the students will end up at the coffee pot with their own peers.
Right. You had to get out of the bubble.
How do you get out of it? That's exactly right. And the way you get out of the bubble is you go someplace where you're not surrounded by folks who also wear the uniform. And it's a very, very salutary experience.
Well, and I have to ask you, what do you think about those generals who called for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign?
Well, I'm uncomfortable with it. And the reason is that a fear that a lot of us have that this could lead to politicization of the military, where the big criteria for selecting senior military officers might be the fact that, gosh, this is a guy we can trust who won't open his mouth after he retires. That shouldn't be what has to be the concern. The objective should be to get senior military officers who will offer the best, most forthright military advice.
But doesn't that go right to the heart of what you're saying, that the military is trying to encourage, you know, these designated skeptics? If someone thinks that, you know, they're going to either be put down or not listened to or perhaps not get the higher ranking job?
Robin, there are plenty of venues within the military to express your concerns.
You're saying
keep it within uniform.
Keep it within.
Well, yes, exactly. There's lots of opportunities. And if it is really that big an issue with you, then, frankly, your obligation should be to pack up the saddle and move on to another endeavor.
And perhaps make your statement that way?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, General Petraeus, President Bush, as you know, has a 32% approval rating for his handling of the war. 57% of Americans feel the U.S. made a mistake by invading Iraq. Ironically, and you're probably hearing this here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, many on the left who originally imposed the invasion now support staying in Iraq to stabilize the country. But many Americans, as you know, feel it's only when the U.S. leaves that Iraq can calm down. What do you think needs to be done to renew the confidence of Americans in the war?
Well, there are always these paradoxes, frankly, in an endeavor like this, and there's certainly always the historic impatience of American people. Clearly, what's required is more of what's happened recently in Iraq, where there's has been important progress in the selection of political leaders for that process to continue.
But, General, forgive me for interrupting, but even as there's been movement on the political front, the security situation has deteriorated. I mean, just last week, the new Sunni vice president's sister was assassinated in a drive-by shooting in Baghdad. It doesn't feel as if things are going well there.
It's a very difficult environment. It's a very difficult endeavor, Robin. We have learned hard lessons, and we will continue to learn them. And I think the key is for an organization to make changes in response to the lessons that it does learn. And I think that that our Secretary-in-Chief very, very much encouraged this and behind it. You know, we actually published an article that was critical in the way that the U.S. was conducting counterinsurgency operations at the beginning of Iraq. We didn't all buy everything that this individual said by any means, but we did publish it in our journal, Military mm-hmm. Review. And the chief of staff of the Army then sent the article out to every single officer in the Army, every single general officer in the Army, with a note that said, read it, study it, discuss it, accept the challenge that it presents to us. That's the right attitude.
Lieutenant General David Petraeus, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's great to be with you, Robin. Thank you.
General Petraeus, the first commander of the Multinational Security Transition Command in Iraq. He's currently commanding general of the U.S. Army Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, and in fact has been visiting colleges across the country, many here in the Massachusetts area, where he and other military officers have been getting an earful from people, part of what he calls his new attempt to get out of the bubble. And we appreciate him speaking with us today. And tomorrow on Here and Now, how much does it cost to fight the war in Iraq? We're going to look at some of the numbers beyond the high cost of reconstruction. Did you know, for instance, it costs $361,000 a year to keep a soldier in Iraq? That's tomorrow. More ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
In modern American history, who has not vetoed a bill? Not a single one in over 5 years. He's signed every bill passed by Congress with great fanfare and photo opportunities. And then, according to a recent story in the Boston Globe, the president has used something called a signing statement to declare that he'll ignore portions of the law. In fact, according to a Globe study, the president has used signing statements to disobey more than 750 laws on topics as varied as intelligence, military rules, affirmative action, and whistleblower protections. Charlie Savage reported the piece in the Globe. He joins us now. Charlie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And give us some specific examples where you say the president has used this signing statement.
Two examples that really brought this practice to light in recent months, after both the media and Congress essentially ignored what Bush had been saying in these statements for the last 5 years, were the torture ban, which he fought hard against, John McCain's torture ban in Congress late last year. Finally, when it was clear that there were enough votes in both chambers that they were going to pass it overwhelmingly, he called a press conference with McCain and said he accepted it, it was good, it was he would sign it. He did sign it in a public ceremony. And then he filed one of these statements saying that when the military went to implement this law, they should keep in mind that the Constitution gives him the power as commander-in-chief to decide what to do about national security, and that he had the authority to waive the torture ban. Another example would be the USA Patriot Act Reauthorization Act, which was passed in March. To get that bill passed after a long fight in Congress, the bill was amended to have a whole lot more oversight provisions than the original had. When Bush signed that bill in a big public ceremony, he simply praised it as a great thing. In his signing statement, he instructed the Justice Department to keep in mind that he had the power to withhold information if he so chose, because he was the president.
Well, and as you say, the Bush administration is calling this an interpretation. You cite many critics, legal scholars, who say that in these signing statements, President Bush is end-running Congress, completely subverting the process. But you also speak to Jack Goldsmith, a Harvard Law School professor, who, as you point out, oversaw the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel for this administration until last year. But he says the statements don't change the law. They just let people know how the president is interpreting it. You know, for future scholars looking back at the law, he says nobody reads them. They have no significance. You say to that?
Well, Professor Goldsmith's point is a subtle one. His point is that a president can still instruct the bureaucracy that it's going to implement a law in a certain way without making a public document about it. He can still just order them to interpret a law in a certain way. And certainly we saw that with the domestic spying program, where there was no public notice that Bush had reinterpreted the 1978 law requiring the government to get warrants whenever it wiretaps American phones. These signing statements, Professor Goldman says, are actually a good thing because, for once, the administration is being very open about what its legal theories are when it doesn't have to be. But the point is, to a degree that is unprecedented in American history, the Bush administration has declared that it can disobey hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of laws that have been enacted by Congress and signed into law by the president's hand at the same time that he says that he does not have to obey many provisions within these laws. It explains the mystery of why he has never vetoed a bill, because when you veto a bill, number one, you have to take the political heat for having vetoed the bill, and number two, Congress has a chance to override that veto. You know, it's interesting because when Tony Snow last week was named White House press secretary, mm-hmm. one of the things that was happening is that people were scouring his old Fox News statements to see places where he had criticized the White House. And one of the ones that got a lot of attention was where he had accused Bush of being impotent. He was complaining that Bush had never vetoed a bill. Bush has never vetoed a bill because he's figured out a way that is much more powerful than a veto to take out legislation that he doesn't like.
And put this in context for us, Charlie, because as you write, this, it's always been a practice available to presidents, but it really began to be used in the 80s. But how does President Bush use it compared to, let's say, more recent presidents?
Going way back in history, presidents have occasionally said that some provision within a large bill is unconstitutional and they're not going to enforce it. And they've occasionally issued signing statements to that effect. Not until the 80s did this become a regular practice, but it's still evolved since then. In the Reagan administration, there was a realization by Edwin Meese, the attorney general at the time, and Sam Alito, who was a young Justice Department attorney at the time, that signing statements could be used to increase executive power. When there's an ambiguous law, courts later have to figure out what that law is supposed to mean when there's litigation over it. Their idea was, when there's ambiguous language like this, let's leave a record of what we think it means, too, when we signed it. Bush's father issued a couple hundred of these over his 4 years. President Clinton issued about 140 over his 8 years. President Bush has broken all those records by far. He's only been in office 5 years. He's already issued more than 750. That's one way in which this is very different. Another way in which this is very different is that these are not intended to help guide the thinking of courts when they review these issues. Most of these things will never get into court. They involve national security, they involve secret overseas and military operations where there is not an opportunity for a plaintiff withstanding to file a lawsuit. This is a unilateral final word on the president's own powers being issued by the president.
And you quote New York University law professor David Golub as saying that no one can be certain of which laws President Bush thinks are valid and which he thinks he can ignore.
Professor Golub's point is that not only has President Bush challenged openly the 750-plus statutes which were enacted under his watch by issuing these statements when he signed those bills into law, but he's cast a cloud over numerous swaths of pre-existing laws that were on the books before he became president. Because if he thinks all these statutes are unconstitutional, the same reasoning would apply to many, 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 many more laws which have been on the books for a long time.
If there have been 750 of these signing statements, at least, where's Congress on this, especially because, as you write, many of these signing statements are attached to the very provisions that were used to get lawmakers to sign a bill?
As in the case of the Patriot Act. Well, the thing is that no one is used to looking at these things. Congress is not reading them. There was a little bit of a political flap after the torture ban because I and later other reporters wrote about it. There was a little bit of flap after the Patriot Act signing statement for the same reason. But the vast majority of these things are entered into the federal record without fanfare, and no one knows they're there, at least no one outside of the executive branch. And so for that, that's one reason that Congress is nowhere on this.
Well, you've said that some of these signing statements are attached to provisions that have to do with national security, so they're hard to access in some ways. I mean, how do you know? How do you know that there are 750 signing statements?
Well, you can count them. The signing statements are in the federal record, even though no one bothers to read them. So you can download them from the weekly compilation of presidential documents, and some of them are posted on the White House website. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to go through them and understand what they're talking about. The further difficulty is when it involves restrictions on what the military can do and what spy services can do, restrictions on what kind of information will be turned over to Congress. There is no way to verify whether or not these things are having a real-world impact or merely assertions in a sort of chest-thumping way that the executive branch has certain powers that Congress can't encroach on.
And what does the White House say in response to this?
They are singularly uninterested in talking about it.
Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, he's recently written extensively about President Bush's use of signing statements to declare portions of laws illegal. And to learn more, you can go to our website here-now.org. Charlie, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, how bad are gas prices? School systems across the country are scaling back on field trips this year to save money on fuel costs, and some schools here in Massachusetts, for instance, are charging kids who live a long distance money to ride the bus. According to the National Association for Pupil Transportation, school systems are paying as much as 50% more for fuel this year compared to last. Many districts included more money in their budgets for gas to run their buses, but they're still struggling to pay their transportation bills this spring. One of them is Ray County, Tennessee, where students just had an extra long weekend off yesterday and Friday so the system could save on fuel. School officials say they'd plan to take advantage of unused snow days if fuel prices jumped anyway, but still. Brad Harris is finance director for Ray County. He joins us from his office in Dayton, Tennessee. And Mr. Harris, give us some context here. This is diesel fuel we're talking about, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And how much are you paying this year compared to, say, a year ago?
It appears to be about a 40% increase per gallon this year.
Well, that's a lot.
Yes.
We understand the schools spent $14,000 on fuel in March compared to about $7,800 in March of 2005.
That's correct.
And did this sneak up on you all at once, or has it been creeping up over the year?
Well, it's obviously been going up for the last year or so, yeah, incrementally each month, and hopefully it's reached a peak, but nobody knows. They're right, telling us next year to maybe expect $3 a gallon. We're probably averaging $2.50 right now.
Right. Well, and we read that over the fiscal year so far, you've spent more than $100,000 on fuel.
Yes.
Compared to $68,000 last year. How, you know, besides taking, a couple of days of closing the school, how were you paying for the difference?
We budgeted a large increase over last year. So as far as having the money in our budget to pay for it, we feel pretty good at this point that we're going to be okay through the end of the fiscal year.
Yeah. And we understand that, school transportation and the cost of it, it's significant in your region. Explain to us, how many people can walk to school? What's the geography there?
Oh, very few could walk to school. Our high school is located in the center of the county, and not a lot of residential property around the high school, so it would be very difficult for people to walk.
34 miles end-to-end is the whole county, so that's a big swath. What are parents saying about this effort to, make the fuel budget by closing schools?
I haven't really heard any parents talk about it. I do know that down here people are perplexed that this is even a story.
Well, some would say, geez, it's come to this that schools have to close because there's not enough money for fuel to gas up the buses. That seems pretty significant.
It does, but now I really feel like we have the money to fuel the buses, but if you have a couple of unused days that are not going to be used, that are built into your total days, it seems to me like a good idea to say, hey, we've got these extra days, we've built into our overall calendar. Why don't we just save a little bit of money and have them off?
Right. This is seems like a huge cost for a small school district.
Sure.
Do things get cut because you're paying for gas, because the gas has ballooned so much?
Well, not this fiscal year because, as I said, we budgeted a large increase in our fuel costs for this year. Now, the budget for next year has not yet been set, but it might very well be that we have to look at conservation somewhere else in order to meet the fuel budget for the next fiscal year.
Have you spoken to other counties in Tennessee? Do other counties have this issue as well?
Yes, it's a statewide and I presume nationwide.
Well, we want to note, too, that even though you're paying this, super high cost of diesel fuel, as a school, you're not paying taxes, right?
Right. It's a governmental unit.
So if you had to pay taxes, it could be even worse.
Exactly, sure.
Yeah, without that break. Well, Brad, just one last thought. We asked about the parents, and you say people really aren't all that concerned quite yet. What about the kids? They must be rooting for the gas prices to go up.
I'm not too far removed from high school, so I can assure you.
Brad Harris, finance director for Ray County, Tennessee. Schools were closed there yesterday and Friday to try to keep to their budget, and because of the high cost of diesel fuel to run the buses there. Brad, any sense of if you'll be closing the schools again because of the fuel issues before summer?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Brad, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Dr. John, his fellow musicians Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, Keith Urban are headlining this year's New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, the first since Hurricane Katrina. Starting last weekend, bands began to roll into the city, bringing music and some economic recovery. Hundreds of local musicians are also making their way to what fans call Jazz Fest. Well, just a few short weeks after Katrina hit, an A-list group of Crescent City musicians assembled in an Austin recording studio, not for a best of or a benefit for victims collection, but to turn tragedy into music. They call themselves the New Orleans Social Club. Singer and keyboard player Henry Butler is part of that collective, and he joins us now from AudioWorks Studio in New Orleans. Welcome.
Good to be here with you.
Well, we understand that reviewers are calling the assembly you were part of the ultimate New Orleans house band. How did it feel for you to be in it?
Well, it was a lot of fun, actually. I got to see how George Porter works as a musical director. And
George Porter of the Meters?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I've played with all the guys, but playing with them in a recording session is a little different. Really, the truth is, it was not just a musical camaraderie. It was real. It was therapy for everybody.
I bet. You mentioned the Meters. Also, members of the Neville Brothers were there, Willie T, Dr. John. The producer, Leo Sachs, said it was sort of, you know, creating a new traveling Wilburys.
Well, and also Raymond Weber was with us. Raymond is one of the, is probably the top studio drummer in New Orleans for funk and R&B.
You say it was therapy. It was to help heal your wounds. Tell us about that. What, you know?
Well, we got together to hopefully contribute to the healing of other people's wounds, but because some of us lost a lot, I certainly lost a house and musical equipment, audio equipment, my whole wardrobe, and as much as you think you're over something like that, it just doesn't happen right away. And for guys to get together, you know, people who went through this tragedy and suffered, for these guys to get together and support each other, joke with each other, you know, talk about how they might heal themselves, that kind of thing. I mean, that's just great for a whole week.
The guys and women there as well. Irma Thomas was there.
Yes.
And Marsha Ball. It sounds as if there were various levels of stardom, even superstardom there, and various levels of wealth, but everybody seemed to have the same sense of loss.
The wealth was certainly in the camaraderie. The wealth was in the support that we gave to each other. The wealth was in the appreciation and the respect that we had for each other. Everybody checked their egos at the door. I know we've heard that phrase before, but it really worked. It really happened.
Yeah. You say, you know, the pain of loss was in that room, but also apparently a lot of anger. There's a strong edge to some of these songs, a rendition of John Fogerty's Fortunate Son. Cyril Neville sings Curtis Mayfield's My Country. Let's just listen to a little of that.
Too many have died protecting my pride. For me to go second class, we've survived the hard blow, and I want you to know that you must face us at last. And I know you give consideration. Shall we perish unjust or live equal as a nation? This is my country.
Henry Butler, we understand that there was a lot of anger in the room, and at one point the producer, Leo Sachs, felt maybe a little too much, and that he asked some people on some of the ballads, and maybe including you on Somewhere, which is one of the songs you sang, to be a little less aggressive.
He did. The idea was to share a little bit of the edge, but also to have some uplifting thoughts, like the song that I sing, Somewhere. Regardless of what happens, there's always a place for us. There's a place that we definitely have to create, but there is that place.
Let's listen to a little bit of Henry Butler's version of Somewhere.
Hold my hand, and we're halfway there. Hold my hand, and I'll take there. Someday
Henry, that is beautiful, and we should say you're on keyboards there as well. So it sounds as if, I mean, what I'm hearing there is a yearning. Did you have to shift from an anger to a yearning?
Well, I was angry about how the so-called leaders responded to the needs of New Orleans. I was taken aback by what the people of New Orleans had to endure and how sad it is that we voted for people who just could not help us. I'm not sure if they could not or deliberately did not.
And I bring this up only out of curiosity. It may be a non-issue. But I'm wondering how you spoke of losing your clothing, your musical instruments, and I'm wondering how, as a person without sight, it was...
Well, that's the other thing. When there's a cataclysmic event like that, everybody is scurrying, everybody is running, and the people who are special or different, you know, they're running too, but it's a different, they're taking different steps.
Right.
Yeah, well, we have to make sure, you know, we don't run into those invisible walls, you know.
Right.
FEMA and the various governmental agencies didn't make any provisions for print handicapped people.
Well, you were evacuated after the Katrina.
Yes, I left and I lodged this complaint on behalf of blind people and print handicapped people who needed assistance in dealing with the FEMA forms and all of the stuff. And still there's a problem with that.
And you're Henry Butler, for crying out loud. I mean, you with, the way the city has embraced you and your music. I mean, I guess everyone was made a little anonymous by Hurricane Katrina.
Even our leaders.
Are you going to go back home? Are you going to go back to New Orleans?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm keeping all of my options open. But because there's no real leadership in the city, they've made it so hard for people to come back. They make it so complicated. There's so much red tape. Insurance companies are still a problem for most people. I don't know yet.
Mm.
I'm not one of those guys that has this blind allegiance to the city of New Orleans, because New Orleans still, unfortunately, the leadership of the city still does some stupid stuff.
New Orleans Social Club member Henry Butler, his new CD, it's called Sing Me Back Home. And we're going to leave you with one of the surprises on the CD, a member of the famed local Boutte family of musicians. This is John Boutte singing Annie Lennox's Why. Henry, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I've heard it said too many times that you'd be better off beside. Why can't you see that this bowl is sinking? This bowl is sinking.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.